continue into the middle of the week, with the next chance of rain coming late Wednesday into Thursday as that cold front tracks across the Midwest. High temperatures today will range from the upper 40s in southern Wisconsin to the upper 60s in western Missouri. Lows tonight will range from the mid-30s in Indiana to the mid-40s in Missouri. The forecast for east central Illinois this afternoon: sunny, the high 55, the wind from the west at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight mostly clear with a low of 33, the wind will be light and from the south. Tomorrow, sunny and warmer, the high 65. The wind will be out of the south from 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly clear. We'll see a low of 42. The wind from the south at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Wednesday, mostly sunny. Look for a high in the upper 60s. The wind will be out of the south at 10 to 15 miles per hour with gusts to 25 miles per hour. Wednesday night, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers. The low will be in the mid-40s. Thursday, cooler. Showers are likely. There's a chance we could see thunderstorms on Thursday as well. Look for a high in the low 50s. The outlook for Thursday night, mostly cloudy with a low in the low 40s. At noon central time, temperatures across the two states, Illinois and Indiana, ranged from the upper 40s to the upper 50s, most locations reporting sunshine. At Rockford, it was 47, 51 at O'Hare, in Bloomington, 50, Mattoon, 52, Carbondale, 59. At South Bend, it was 48 degrees, in Lafayette, 55, and at Indianapolis and Terre Haute, 57 degrees. Willard Airport reported 51 degrees at the top of the hour, the sky sunny. The dew point, 39, the relative humidity, 63%, the wind out of the northwest at 8, the barometric pressure, 30.08, and rising. And at 12:39, 54 degrees in Urbana. On the campus of the University of Illinois, the sky is sunny. On this day in 1926, the great escape artist and magician Harry Houdini died. At the time, many people believed it was possible for the living to contact the dead. They included the creator of Sherlock Holmes, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and Houdini's wife, Bess. So for 10 years after his death, Bess Houdini tried to contact her husband's spirit through a medium.
"We are watching and waiting, Harry. Levitate the table. Ring the bell. Do it, Harry. Please, Houdini, we are waiting. Bessie is waiting."
As a matter of fact, Houdini was a great skeptic of seances. Still, the seances to try to contact Houdini continue to this day. Little has been heard over the years from the Houdini family. As this, the 85th anniversary of Houdini's death, approached, reporter David Crocker sat down with a Houdini relative who unlocked some family secrets.
First thing you need to know is that the Houdinis had no children, so pay close attention to this family tree. George Hardine is the great-nephew of Harry Houdini. His grandfather was Theo Hardine, also an escape artist and Houdini's brother. A pretty close connection, right? But here's the rub. George Hardine, growing up in Danbury, Connecticut, didn't even know he was related to Houdini.
"Until I was probably 11, 12.
Even though his father was his namesake.
Harry Houdini Hardine.
Harry Hardine rarely used his middle name and barely spoke of the family's connection to Houdini when his children were young.
Put it in perspective, he grew up in that world, and the world was focused on Houdini and my grandfather. He said he didn't want me running out into the street and telling every kid, because of course nobody would believe me."
Now 59, George Hardine looks more like Houdini than his grandfather ever did. Handsome, with bright blue eyes. Similar to writer Edna Ferber's description of Houdini's eyes as very much inclined to twinkle. But like his father, George Hardine did not go into the family business. In fact, the stories he heard about his famous grandfather mostly came from his mother.
"Seeing my grandfather practice, rolling coins on his fingers to keep nimble so that they're able to manipulate locks and get out of straitjackets. And of course, you know, they're hiding things in their hands all the time. Cards, picks. It was the art of illusion. They were not magicians, they were illusionists.
The illusions included their own personas. Houdini was really Eric Weiss. He borrowed the name from a French magician. Hardin, his younger brother, was Theodore Weiss. Their father left Budapest in the late 1870s. He settled in Appleton, Wisconsin, where he became the town's rabbi. His wife and young children followed him.
My great-grandfather was hoping for a better life for him and his family. The family always suffered financially from an early age. The stories of Houdini, he would go out and do tricks and bring money home and give it to his mother and help the family out.
Ladies and gentlemen, I take great pleasure in introducing my latest invention, the water tortoise shell.
That's Houdini describing his most famous escape. From a glass tank filled with water while he's shackled upside down inside. This 1914 recording is part of illusionist David Copperfield's collection.
Should anything go wrong when I'm locked up, one of my assistants walks through the curtain, ready to rush in, demolishing the glass in order to save my life.
Houdini's wife, Bess, was his stage partner, but before they married, Houdini performed with his brother, Hardin. And Hardin recently showed up as a character in his own right, in the HBO series Boardwalk Empire, set in Prohibition-era Atlantic City.
I saw your brother do that straitjacket gag once.
Eric Houdini, as you know him, used to do that escape behind the ghost box where no one could see him. Playing it out in the open was my idea.
Oh, yes.
Well, whoever's idea it was, it's clear what the brothers were doing seemed to everyone like the impossible. Again, George Hardin.
One of the things that my dad told me when I'd say, how did they do this? He would simply explain it was practice and knowledge. It was a work ethic. They worked at simply being the best.
Harry Houdini was 52 when he died, apparently from a ruptured appendix. And after his wife Bess stopped the seances, 10 years was long enough to wait for any man, she said, Houdini enthusiasts resumed them. Theo Hardin died in 1945. His grandson George, after declining several seance invitations, finally decided to see what they were all about. It was Halloween night in 2001, the 75th anniversary of his great uncle's death.
They had a big round table, some articles that belonged to Houdini, and they would beseech him to just show a sign, and after about a half an hour, they'd throw in the towel, and then it was over. And then we went to this really nice bar and drank scotch and just visited. And I'll tell you what, they know everything about Houdini, and I felt very ignorant in their presence, but that didn't matter to them, because I'm the guy that's got the DNA.
And then the guy with the DNA went home. Home is on the Navajo Nation in Tuba City, Arizona.
And that is my oldest horse. Boy, he is looking old, poor guy.
George Hardin came to Arizona in the early 80s to pursue a career in journalism. He fell in love with the landscape, the people, and he never left.
But now, you know, the Houdini legacy has taken a new branch because my wife is Navajo and my children are enrolled members of the Navajo Nation. And eventually they will have children. And so who knows where this Houdini DNA will actually end up.
And tonight, like every Halloween, the official Houdini seance will take place. This year at a historic mansion in Holyoke, Massachusetts, but without Houdini DNA at the table. For NPR News, I'm Daniel Crocker.
Every Halloween, one street in Concord, New Hampshire, attracts hundreds, sometimes thousands, of kids with hard-to-believe treats. One home scoops up orange sherbet, another hands out full-sized candy bars. Families on the block spend hundreds of dollars on candy every year. Nobody wants to be the house that runs out. Dan Gorenstein reports.
On any day, Auburn Street's impressive. Well-to-do historic homes, long lawns, towering trees up on a hill above the city. But on Halloween, Auburn Street becomes a city of gold, a place where a kid can pack a pillowcase full of candy and be dazzled by the outrageous.
There's one that's a Grinch house.
Candy cane sticking out of the ground.
They have, like, Christmas lights all over the place.
It's like this big yellow house.
Like this huge tree.
Somebody dressed as the Grinch give out candy.
And, like, all these fake presents lying around. It's just fantastic.
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch.
We have music. You can hear it for blocks up the street, which I think a lot of our neighbors hate.
For the past six Halloweens, Mila Stewart has transformed her lawn into a vision of Dr. Seuss's Whoville. She buys 4,000 mini candy canes every year to give it that authentic feel. Auburn Street's reputation for excess and the exotic offering is known well beyond town limits.
I am known in New Hampshire as the ice cream lady. The old people go, oh my God, you're the ice cream house. And I think, no, I'm Teresa Rosenberger. No, you're the ice cream lady.
The last few years, Rosenberger, her husband Eric, and their team of friends have scooped up well over 1,000 cones of orange sherbet on Halloween. And Eric says the crowds keep growing.
So this year, last night I was trying to figure out, how to estimate what to buy. So I'm going to go with 1,800 and see what happens.
That's 50 gallons of sherbet.
How much are you spending?
Oh, gosh. I'd say probably close to $1,000.
Rosenberger says her treat sometimes can be a great trick.
And it's just great fun to see these little kids who have never been before. And all of a sudden, they see ice cream and they'll squeal, ice cream, mommy, look, ice cream. And then sometimes they'll take it, lick it, and then turn it over into their bag upside down. And it's so much fun to watch the parent panic. Oh my God, you just put ice cream on all your chocolate candy.
Not everyone on the block delights in the festivities. Anna Burtnett says she enjoys the kids on her porch in costume, but she thinks the celebration's too much.
We have a culture of excess, and we're continuing to feed that by buying hundreds and thousands of dollars worth of candy. It'd be okay if we cut back a little bit.
Back across the street, Eric Rosenberger is sympathetic to his neighbor's view. He says he thinks it's important to make substantive contributions, like donating to food pantries. But Rosenberger says he thinks scoops of orange sherbet do some good, too.
In the economic times that we're in, I think it's nice to do what you can to bring a little more joy into the world.
That's certainly the way 7-year-old Colin Hagen sees it.
Everything about Auburn Street on Halloween is just great. Not great, but fantastic. It's like the best street you've ever trick-or-treated on.
For NPR News, I'm Dan Gorenstein in Concord, New Hampshire.
The October campaign is winding down, and we made real progress towards reaching our membership support goal. Every gift brings us one step closer to ensuring that we have the resources to bring you the programs you enjoy. If you received a renewal